Welcome to Inside Investing. Today we have Paul Brodsky of Copernic Asset Management and Jason Voss and Bob Stammers of the CFA Institute. And Paul, I just want to ask, you know, one of the things that was very provocative in your writing is the allegory of the cave. And I wonder if we could start by sort of unpacking how that relates to your views about sort of investment markets around the world.
Thank you, Will. I used Plato's allegory of the cave as a means of introducing something that is somewhat delicate to do among sophisticated investors and market observers, and that was, what if we were all just looking at the wrong thing and reality was somewhere behind us and we were just really looking at shadows? And I found that his allegory of the cave gave me a good introduction in the way to do that. And I'm not one to try and say that I know something that everyone else doesn't. I don't think I do, but I think public emphasis is misdirected on a lot of things that are relatively second-order issues that aren't driving economies, aren't driving markets. And so I use that allegory as an allegory, if you will, so to try and bring that issue up as it related to economics and markets.
Got it. So how does it relate specifically to how we experience sort of currency?
Well, currency is a funny thing. Without getting too theoretical and going back too far, there's currency and there's money, and they're not necessarily the same thing. Currency can be anything that is exchanged for something else and kept, I guess. And we've chosen to accept dollars, euros, yen, whatever, as our currencies. Not necessarily because they represent wealth, per se, but because we can buy stuff with them and then save it and hopefully use it again to buy stuff with it in the future. So money has historically fulfilled that role, but I make the case that when we went off a fixed exchange rate to gold, and it doesn't have to be gold, and I don't want to start out with gold, but when we went off of something acting as a basis for money, it opened the world to baseless currency that didn't have any anchor for purchasing power value. And, you know, we call these fiat currencies because governments proclaim them by fiat to have value. But in reality, they're created in the banking system, not by governments. Certainly in the U.S. that's true. And what happens when you go into a bank or go online these days and take out a loan, the bank creates effectively unreserved currency. They lend it into existence. I guess an analogy would be when you are a bond trader and you start to trade before an auction, a treasury auction, you start to trade bonds on a when-issued basis based on the yield, and then a week later there's the actual auction and it goes off smoothly, but they actually create the bonds, you actually start to trade the bonds before they're actually in existence and created. That's much the same thing that's been happening on a secular basis with our currencies. We have base money that is the bank reserves plus physical currency in flow. That's our money. And up until 2008, there was about $850 worth of base money. But yet you had about 20 trillion or so, depending on how one counts, in bank deposits. So how can that be? Well,
so I'm sorry, $850.
$850 billion.
You left off your billions.
I left off my billions. So it's easy to do when the numbers get so large, even though that's a relatively small one. So we had over a 20-to-1 ratio of we can call it credit currency, that, you know, over base money, but they were deposits, because obviously you can't have a deposit without having a currency in which it's denominated. So that defines leverage in the banking system. Now, as we know, through QE, the Fed has been creating base money in the form of bank reserves, in effect deleveraging the banking system. However, they're not deleveraging the rest of us. They're not deleveraging other non-bank balance sheets. Certainly not the government, which is becoming more leveraged. Certainly not households, which are holding their own, but not becoming deleveraged. And so the big numbers, according to the Fed, are something like, in total public debt outstanding, publicly traded debt, I think it might be what they call it, approaching $60 trillion. And this is on a base money, dollar-denominated base money, of now $3.2 trillion after QE or shooting up with a bullet. But that means that it's creating tremendous pressure on the real economy to service and perhaps repay all the debt that's now outstanding.
Perhaps being the operative word.
I don't think it ever has to be actually repaid, because certainly not in full, but it certainly puts pressure on all of us, households, businesses, obviously governments, to find the money to service the debt. And if we want to get out of debt and we want to deleverage our own balance sheets, we actually need the money to do it. And it's not there. It's just not in existence. So this is why the Fed and other central banks, I think, have to continue to create base money. Now it's in the form of bank reserves, which is deleveraging the commercial banks. Sometime soon, I have a feeling it could be in the form of currency in circulation or something for the rest of us. And so that's where we get to the fear of inflation.
Can we go back to the point about the gold standard? And I've actually written in defense of gold standard, not necessarily because I'm a gold standard defender. I am a defender of having a meaningful conversation about it. It seems that the people who dismiss gold standard, they frequently make some sort of foolish comment along the lines of, well, you know, once wampum was accepted for means of exchange as well. And what I tried to do was recharacterize this debate and point out that if something has a demand curve and it's universally accepted, if it meets those two criteria, it actually can serve as a currency. I mean, do you agree with that? Was that why gold works?
Yeah. Well, I think that's why fiat currencies are working presently.
That's what I was just going to say. Yeah.
Because they are in demand. We don't have to question why. I mean, we can, but the important point that you cite is that they are demanded. They were originally demanded so that we could pay our taxes, right? Way back when. They continue to be in demand for that reason. We can't pay U.S. taxes in anything but U.S. dollars.
And so we can buy goods and services.
And obviously so that we can go to the corner bodega and pick up whatever we want. They won't take wampum, they won't take gold, they won't take anything else. It's become socially acceptable and socially accepted to use dollars. Now, the gold standard, you know, a lot of people looking at a gold standard in today's highly sophisticated, broad, huge-scale economies would be right to say it sounds so archaic. It's an anachronism, you know. In today's very sophisticated world, the scale now of financial assets, of monetary balances, fiat monetary balances, just so large compared to the amount of gold. Would I have to shave off, you know, a tiny bit of gold to pay for a pack of gum? You know, that's really not what we're talking about when we talk about a gold standard in a contemporary society. That would have been, way back when, that may have worked in the 19th century in the West and what have you. But I think the important point to remember here is that it acts as a basis on which all the transaction-based currencies can be tied, can be exchanged into.
So the limited supply aspect is something you think that makes the gold standard a little bit more unique, because that's essentially what establishes the base. You can't invent more of it.
I think that's it. Thanks. It's the scarcity aspect that has to be there to make money truly perpetual in its value. The only reason that we would continue to hold dollars is and work for dollars, and this is a very important point, labor for money to save, is if we felt that the money would be worth saving 3, 4, 5, 10 years down the road. And if that's ever put into question, based on all these monetary authority, money printing, then that's where something's scarce. Precedent has it as, monetary metals, as gold and sometimes silver. But that's gives it its value.
Well, that's the reason for buying gold in the first place, if you think there isn't a real return on savings, right? A real return on currency.
That's
so
right.
Unless the market thinks that there's, a positive return after inflation, then there's no reason to hold currency, right? You're going to find something else.
That's right. And for the purposes of financial markets, it also leads into, these are the currencies that are financial assets are denominated. Obviously, the most direct result, market is in bonds, where you actually have an overt rate of interest on a bond, and you can decide, if I pay par for this bond, and I get par back plus 1 or 2 or 3% a year, but a head of lettuce is going to rise every year by 4 or 5 or 6%, or college educations or homes or whatever it may be, then why am I doing this? So as you say, the real rate of return is negative. And that's the easiest place to see that. It may also be true that holding equity, real estate, other types of assets that are denominated in these currencies could also provide us positive nominal rates of return, but negative real rates of return over time.
Can we go back to the criteria I outlined, not because I went ahead Trump at the research I did, but the other thing I said was universally accepted. And the reason why that is important, I want to return to it, is because I think your own personal beliefs are that may be in question, the universally accepted, that there are forces assembling, you've sort of alluded to them in some of your remarks, about the ever-escalating pile of debt that not just the U.S. government holds, but government of China, government of India, European Union as well. It sounds like what you believe, and please feel free to speak to this if you'd like, that you think that universally accepted part may be in jeopardy.
It's a very tricky question. It sets up your question sets up, and I think rightfully so. It sets up some type of adversarial relationship between those that advocate for currency or money that holds its value, and those that advocate for the status quo because everything runs smoothly and it's easy to manage. And I guess that's true, but I'm not going to place a bet on who's going to win the outcome, so I want to distinguish there. I don't think that it's likely in this day and age, maybe I'm wrong, but in this day and age, that some, disaggregated masses of potential consumers and savers in the United States and Europe and Asia are going to rise up in a grassroots way and figure out that their currencies are increasingly being diluted and therefore rise up and storm the Eccles building. I kind of doubt that. I think you know, popular dissent takes its form in other areas and in other ways. And, you know, I'm not saying people won't take to the streets because they can't find a job, but I think that's the way it would be manifest rather than thinking of it as a monetary issue. I don't think that's the way it would come out. I do think, though, that the same people that have been managing our monetary and currency systems, as well as our fiscal policies, and that are in control, the monetary authorities, if you will, are going to come to the conclusion themselves because they know how the system is working and how it's not working and how it's failing. They're going to come to the conclusion that it's in their best interest to change the system, to somehow create first, I think they're going to have to broadly deleverage the system that I mentioned before, the tremendous amount of debt outstanding versus the amount of money with which to service and repay it. They're going to have to deleverage that. There's only two ways that I know of, possibly three, to deleverage anything. One is to just write it off as, you know, a debt jubilee of biblical times. I don't see that happening here or anywhere else of substance, because that destroys the credit function going forward, the banking function going forward. It's just too problematic, I think. Once you were to do that, I think you would destroy economies for a long, long time, and I don't think that's in anyone's interest. The other way is to let debt deteriorate on its own, because people wouldn't have enough money to service and repay their debt. So, as we saw in the 1930s, you would see the value of debt, and of course, that's credit in the banking system. That would deteriorate. We'd have massive bank failures, massive household balance sheet failures, insolvencies all over the place, and even among governments. So I don't see that either. And I don't think that's necessary these days, ironically, because we have a baseless fiat monetary system. And so the only means of practically, politically expedient means to deleverage, I think, is by printing the money to repay the debt. And that is, it holds debt covenants. You know, it makes them still legal. We will have enough money with which to repay our debts, with which to maintain the value of bank assets. But the burden of repaying it would go down dramatically. And here's a thought experiment for you to illustrate how this would work. Let's say tomorrow the Fed proclaims that all $1 bills are $10 bills. Magic, okay? Fed chairman says, okay, merchants charge $10 more, or pardon me, 10 times more for your goods and services. Consumers expect to pay 10 times more. Employers, you have to pay your wage earners 10 times more. And guess what? Labor, you're going to make 10 times more. Okay. Everything rises 10x, 10 times.
Everything not fixed to the contract.
Everything except, right, the principal amount of debt outstanding.
So should I be borrowing as much money as I can?
Depends what you do with it, but yes. if it's term, and if it's and if you, yeah, I mean, it makes
it underwritten.
That's right. It makes a case for that. But if you borrow it and you put it into something that, you know, could be neutralized, it could be completely neutralized. But the burden of repaying it, and that's what I've just described, is nothing terribly insightful. It's just the process of inflation. I'm just showing it in one discrete step. And so this is what we've done over many years, slowly. But that's a devaluation of the currency that actually deleverages the system through the process of inflation. Now, there's a few three-syllable words, but that go that make people's minds gloss over, eyes gloss over. But that, I think, is the most likely scenario. Whether or not it happens by proclamation in one step, I don't know, but I think the process of inflation is the only politically expedient way to deleverage the system.
Yeah, I think if you're a cynic, you would say that the genius of the Federal Reserve's plan, as well as the other central banks who are engaging this, government of Japan's another one, is that they've stretched the obligations temporarily, right? So if they had done, per your thought experiment, they do it overnight, that would be shocking and jarring, but death by paper cut, on the other hand, is palatable. And, it goes unobserved, basically.
Right. Well, what we've seen, if you just look at a graph of CPI over the last 40 years, it's risen, let's say, 2% a year. CPI inflation is grown about 2% a year, or give or take. But over time, that's really diminished the purchasing power of the dollar saved. Why haven't we balked? Why aren't we up in arms? Well, it's because we've made a lot more money, in financial assets and the value, nominal values of our homes and in our assets. Our wages have risen. And so it's all been good. But really what has happened, what this has been, is a grand leveraging of the system. And that's what it shows. So can we continue that slowly? Well, I guess if there's demand for more credit to purchase more assets, that will overcome the rate of inflation. But I would argue that that's not very likely, given where we stand now, given our demographics in the West, and given, even though we may have infinite desire, we can't have infinite demand because we have to now pay the piper for the means of that demand, i.e. credit. So my thought is somewhere, probably soon, we're going to have to deleverage that.
And that gets into sort of this. I mean, it's provocative that you've moved to a firm called Copernic Asset Management. You bring up the Copernicus quantity theory of money in some of your writings. I mean, I wonder if you could talk about sort of as we walk through this money printing exercise, sort of what may happen in your view to the way, I guess, individuals experience life and as well investors experience life.
By the way, exercise is a great word because look how big we've gotten.
Boy, the calorie count's certainly gone up.
Yeah, exactly.
So the quantity theory of money, I mean, this is a concept that, and Copernicus, someone that put the sun at the center of the universe, the solar system, before anyone else did, and so he was courageous enough to put forth what he thought was right, but way before Adam Smith and Ricardo and certainly Keynes and everyone else, he kind of through logic discovered for himself that the more money out there, the higher prices would rise because the money would chase the price, would chase the goods and services. And it was just the supply of money would be in constant tension with the supply of goods and services. So if you produce more money, a greater supply, it would increase nominal prices. And that's, now it sounds like it's fairly obvious. Interestingly, though, it's not the way we treat things today, which is, I think, very, very weird. We are, as I mentioned before, that demand, or I mentioned before that desire is infinite, and of course it is. We all want everything whenever we can get it, as soon as we can get it, that's a natural human condition, right? But we don't have the means to turn that desire into, shall we say, economic demand. Okay, mm-hmm. We need money. We need wealth. We need something to do it. We either have to produce something as individuals and as societies to get the demand to fulfill our desires, to get the money, which is the gives us the means to fulfill our desires, or assets to do that, or we have to borrow from someone that has produced. I mean, logic would tell you that. So, but in today's Keynesian-based economies, the policy is that aggregate demand has to always be increased. We see this coming from the highest echelons of our universities, and on Wall Street and in Washington and among politicians and policymakers and monetary authorities. It's very accepted that aggregate demand is the holy grail of a healthy economy. And I'd argue that that's not true, or if it is, that's not where it should start. I think what we need to look at is production, because production is the only way that we can create sustainable aggregate demand. What we've done as a bridge, we've seen production, and I think the United States economy is a perfect microcosm of this, if you call the largest economy a microcosm. But we've our level of production has tailed off over the last 20, 30 years, certainly relative to our economy, and yet demand has increased. Well, what has been the bridge that has allowed aggregate demand, meaning let's call it output growth or GDP, it's just risen. How has that happened? Well, it's been credit. We've been given the means to consume, but we haven't been increasing our production. Does that make sense to you? Well, it makes sense to me that it's happened, but it doesn't make sense to me that it can continue indefinitely.
Well, at some point you hit a limit, the amount of credit that's available, right?
I would think so, or else people would start to question what it is they're doing. And we talked before about I think it all comes down, eventually it comes down to the currency in which it's all being counted. It's not the value of labor, the value of a hard day's work in a coal mine or at a waiting tables or doing anything productive is never changes. I mean, that value is there. What changes is the price, right? Yeah. And what's changing the price is, as Copernicus said, the quantity of money, and in this case, credit.
Yeah,
and it's very temporary because it's credit. And if I can just take it a step further, so it's credit on its own is good. I mean, just if you say, okay, can I borrow some money? Yes, please. And here are the terms of this agreement. I'm going to borrow from you, you're going to give me credit, and I'm going to take it and I'm going to invest it and put it and form capital, I think. Or I'm going to speculate, or whatever I'm going to do, this is what I'm going to do. Okay. So we enter into an agreement, and I'm indebted to you, and you loan me money, and I go out and I build something, a factory, a restaurant, a new microprocessor, whatever it might be, I build it. And I employ some people or I don't, and that's it. I can win or I can lose. Okay, if it's a successful business, I pay you back plus interest. The economy created capital, it formed capital. That's the way everything is supposed to work. If I fail, I don't pay you back, you lose money, you say, oh shucks. I'm okay, I might have to sell some things, but I took a risk and I lost. that was a reserved transaction because you loaned me money that you earned through production to, and you took a risk on me. When I go to a bank, that's not what happens. When I go to a bank, they create from thin air the loan to me. It's unreserved, or it's
fractionally
reserved.
Yeah.
And if I win or I lose in my speculation on my business, do they care? Well, they care because if enough of losers like me fail, then they're going to report a down quarter, right? They're going to have to write some loans off. But they've got the Fed to come in and provide them more money. So you can lend me money. The private sector can lend each other money. Credit is a good thing when it produces capital, right? You can lend me money, and I can fail or I can win, and you win or fail, you know, lose as a result. But it's not the case in the banking system. It's an inequitable situation, and we're in a position where bank regulators are also working on behalf of their banks as their primary advocate as well. So, again, the rest of us are kind of out here, fully willing and able to loan each other money, and that's a closed credit transaction. That there's going to be a winner and a loser, or possibly two winners from that if capital is created. But that's not the case in the fractionally reserved bank.
I think that dynamic is pretty well understood, actually, believe it or not, by an increasing number of people, which is great.